Thanks for coming. Thanks for having me. So I guess Rob Speckens gave a very similar talk last week. So assuming a lot of people realize that. if you guys are at that talk, I just want to give you a fair warning that this talk will be about the same experiment, so it will be quite similar. So just heads up. but yeah, okay, so I'm going to talk about non-contextuality. This is joint work that I did with Matt Pusey, who's a postdoc here, Ravi Kunjwal, who's a student at Chennai, Kevin Rush, who's my supervisor at IQC. We do quantum optics, and Rob Speckens, who is here, obviously. So the kind of the main point of this talk is to talk about how to find a good way to distinguish between classical physics and the laws of nature. And what's a good way to, how can we distinguish well between classical physics and nature? As well, we need a good notion of classicality. Ideally, we want this notion of classicality to be experimentally testable. So we can, I'm an experimentalist, I like to go in the lab and challenge the predictions of theorists. So an example of an experimentally testable notion of classicality would be the assumption of local realism, and specifically the CHSH inequality that was formulated based on that assumption. So CHSH, we're able to operationally define or make some operational predictions based on this assumption of local realism. And then if an experimentalist can violate this inequality in the lab, then that rules out this assumption. I'm going to argue today that maybe there's a better notion of non-classicality and or a better notion of classicality, which I'll call non-contextuality. Non-contextuality can be defined operationally, which, as we'll see, will lead to an experimental test. And very loosely speaking, I'll define it more carefully later, but it's just the idea that if two experimental procedures in the lab are operationally identical, so basically there's no measurements that can tell them apart, or nothing you can do to tell them apart to get different statistics, then maybe we should represent them equivalently, these two procedures equivalently in the model underlying our system. That's the assumption of non-contextuality. Something else that's nice is it's applicable to a wider range of scenarios than the assumption of local realism. Local realism only really applies to space-like separated pairs of particles or sets of particles. But non-contextuality can be applied to local systems. There are still some experimental challenges with non-contextuality, and that's with testing it, and that's what I'll talk about today. And the main challenge stems from this constraint that two experimental procedures have to be operationally equivalent. It's very hard to go in the lab and measure two things that are exactly identical. But I'll talk today about how we overcame that issue, or skirted it, I should say. Okay, so for this talk, I'd like to introduce ontological models, and more carefully define what I mean by non-contextuality. Then I'll talk about an inequality that Ravi and Rob derived, and that we tested. I'll talk about how we overcame this problem of imperfect operational equivalence in the lab, and then I'll go over an experiment that we did. So we'll start at the beginning with ontological models. So an ontological model is an attempt to provide a causal reason for correlations between kind of preparation procedures in the lab and outcomes of measurements that you can perform later. So a preparation procedure, which I'm just representing by this little box, which spits out our system, which I'm representing by this little pink particle. So our preparation procedure can prepare our system in one of many ontic states, lambda. So lambda is kind of a full specification of all the variables in the system. Our preparation procedure doesn't have to deterministically assign one specific lambda to the state, but it can be a probability distribution, which is represented with mu of lambda given preparation procedure p. Measurements are defined in a similar way, and measurement procedures return outcomes probabilistically based on the ontic state lambda of the system. So measurements are given a response function And for each measurement and each outcome of that measurement, you have a different response function. So these are denoted by the C of outcome B given state lambda and given, so this is the probability of obtaining outcome B on measurement M, given that you're in state, the system is in state lambda. Sorry, did you have a question?
Lambda as, or the preparation of the state as being, having a number of parameters associated with the preparation itself, all right? So the preparation process, so however you do it. And that then is going to produce a state.
Mm-hmm.
And parameters associated with the preparation can be thought of as the parameters of that state. There may be other things that you can do in the future to measure quantities, but if they weren't involved in the preparation, those are not relating to the reality of what you created. They're something to measure in the future as opposed to what you created. I'm trying to really understand what you mean by this ontological state.
So I want to be careful to distinguish between the preparation and the system that comes out. So in the previous slide, I've represented it as this box and the system. So the preparation is a set of instructions that you will carry out in the lab. And those will prepare your particle or your system in some state. As we'll see later, you can have different sets of instructions in the lab which prepare the same ontic state. Well,
so in what sense are you calling that? I mean, you're attributing ontological properties to this state that weren't part of its preparation. So you're thinking of the state as being real, even though that you have no information about that, the distinguishing properties that would then cause it to be something other than explicitly what you prepared.
Sorry, I'm not sure I quite understand.
Okay, so if you go through a preparation process and you generate some output from that process, then how can you say that the output of this process has I'll call it information, or has some attributes that were not there as part of your preparation process? So in what sense can you say that this is an ontic state you produced? When, you know, I could think of it as you may measure in the future some properties, but did they necessarily exist prior to the point of measurement?
Well, I think that's a very...
Are you assuming that they exist before the measurement?
Yeah,
made?
I think that's a very deep question. I'm assuming so that your preparation procedure sets lambda based on some probability distribution. So these attributes do exist as soon as the particle leaves its preparation black box.
So you're assuming lambda has been set, even though you have no basis for making such an assumption.
Well, it's been set probabilistically, based on some distribution. So we don't necessarily know what it is, but we know that it will be drawn from some distribution.
But if you know there's a distribution, can you not go back to the preparation process and say, okay, based on the parameters of my preparation, they describe the state, so whatever the parameters are of that distribution, those are parameters that were involved in the preparation process.
Yeah.
So lambda by itself is kind of a derived concept. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. So we've set lambda based on this preparation, and now we want to kind of measure it with a measurement. The way that I'll represent measurements is with response functions. So as an example, I have a two-outcome measurement here. You can have outcome either 0 or 1. And these are example response functions. So measurements don't have to respond deterministically to lambda, but they can respond probabilistically to the state of the system. And so now what this is saying is the probability of getting outcome 0 given you're performing a measurement M and the state is some system lambda is given by this probability distribution. Okay. So now, if we want to have a good ontological model of our world, we want to make sure that the probabilities that we measure in the lab can be described or can be calculated from our response functions and the ontic state of the system. So what this is the the probability of getting outcome B, given that you perform measurement M and preparation P, is given by the probability response function that you get outcome B, given that you perform measurement M and your state lambda, times the probability that you're in lambda based on your preparation integrated over all lambda. One final note that I want to make is that when we mix experimental procedures probabilistically, then you can just mix their ontic descriptions probabilistically. So for example, if I have a preparation procedure which is the mixture of two procedures, P0 and P1, and the way you could perform that is flip a biased coin in the lab. So with some probability P, you'll get heads. With some probability 1 minus P, you'll get P1. You perform either set of preparation instructions. And then the ontic states just mix together in the same probabilistic way. For measurements, the same thing. You get the same type of thing with the response functions. So now, I talked before about operational equivalence. I'll just define specifically what that means for preparations and measurements. For two preparations, we say that two preparation procedures are operationally equivalent if they cannot be distinguished by any possible measurement in the lab. So what that means specifically, if the set of measurements that you can perform on your system is M, then if you get the same outcome probabilities for preparations P and P prime for all measurements M in the set, then we say that P and P prime are operationally equivalent, which we denote by this squiggly equal sign. Same thing for two measurement procedures. If two measurement procedures, M and M prime, get the same statistics for all preparations that your system allows, then we say that M and M prime are operationally equivalent. So now we can have enough to get to the operational definition of non-contextuality. So the assumption of non-contextuality will relate operational indistinguishability and indistinguishability in the ontic model. And so what this means is that if we have two experimental procedures that are identical in the lab, then we should represent them in the same way in our ontic model. So just formally, we have operational equivalence between two preparations, P and P prime. Then we just assign them the same ontic state. Again, this is operational equivalence for all possible measurements that could be performed. And then for measurements, we have the same thing. If two measurements are operationally indistinguishable, we assign them the same response functions in the lab. So why do we call this non-contextuality? So it just means that our ontic model doesn't rely on the context of our experimental procedure. So as an example, you could consider a two-outcome measurement where you send a photon on a perfectly balanced beam splitter. And so with 50% probability, you'll go to one detector, 50% probability, you'll go to the other. Something else you could do is you could just send your photon onto a beam splitter, ignore the direction that it went, and flip a coin. And with 50% probability, you'll get heads, 50% you'll get tails. Both of those measurements, regardless of the input state that you send into your system, will give you the same outcome statistics. They'll give you 50% outcomes 0, 50% outcomes 1. So in the ontic model, we would describe those as the same measurement. So this is our definition of non-contextuality. Now that we have that definition in this ontological model framework, we can use that assumption to derive an inequality. So just need to define a few experimental procedures, before we start, and then I'll get to the inequality. So we can start with six preparation procedures. I've labeled them P1, 2, and 3. The first index is 1, 2, or 3, and the second index is 0 or 1. And I'll define the equal mixture PT is the equal mixture of PT0 and PT1. for all t. So, and by equal mixture, I just mean that with 50% probability, you perform one, and the 50% probability, you perform the other. Also, let's consider two outcome measurement procedures, M1, M2, and M3. And I'll define M star as the equal mixture of these three measurement procedures. Finally, we'll go back to this example of the coin flip that I was just talking about. M coin is a measurement procedure which totally ignores the state of your system. And outcomes returns outcome 0 or 1 with equal probability. So it's the response functions, regardless of lambda, are equal to 1/2 for both outcomes. So using these experimental procedures, we can define this average degree of correlation. You remember there were 6 preparations, PTB. And the degree of correlation is the average correlations over all T and all B, that if you perform measurement T on preparation TB, so the probability of getting outcome B, given that you've performed measurement T on preparation TB. So now our inequality is if we can show operational equivalence between the three equal mixtures, P1, P2, and P3, and we can also show operational equivalence between the equal mixture of our three measurements and the fair coin flip, then assuming non-contextuality will imply that our average degree of correlation A is less than 5 over 6. So I'll go over a quick argument. I'm not going to prove that A has to be less than 5/6. I'll just prove that A cannot be deterministic. This proof will be by contradiction. So we'll start off by assuming that A is equal to 1. That's the logical maximum. That means that each of these probabilities are equal to 1. This implies that the response functions for measurement T have to be deterministic, which means they can only hold values of either 0 or 1. For all lambda for which the preparation PTB assigns a non-zero probability. And then very quick, this fact implies that the measurement response function has to be deterministic for these equal mixtures PT as well, for all lambda which are in these equal mixtures. Preparation non-contextuality implies, since we have that P1, P2, and P3 are operationally equivalent, preparation non-contextuality applies that their ontic states must be the same, which means that our response functions have to be deterministic for all lambda in the set of lambda that one has sampled in this future experiment. Measurement non-contextuality, however, implies that this equal mixture of the three measurements, M1, M2, and M3, has to be equal to the response function for a fair coin flip, which is 1/2. But now we run into a problem because we have that the response functions have to be deterministic, so they can only be assigned values of 0 or 1. But there's no way to assign three values of 0 and 1 to these three measurements to get 1/2 and to satisfy this constraint. So that's an argument showing that A cannot be equal to 1. We do have a proof that A has to be less than or equal to 5/6. I'm not going to go through it in today's talk. But I will mention that bound is tight. And so that's the inequality that we're going to test, or that we did test. It's very easy, if you assume quantum mechanics, to violate this inequality and to actually achieve the logical limit of A is equal to 1. So these are the ideal states and measurements that you need to violate this inequality maximally. So what I've plotted here is the xz plane of the Bloch sphere. This is just a reminder of the. So I'm plotting the R vector on the Bloch sphere. So preparation 1, 0 and 1, 1, or 2, 0 and 2, 1, 3, 0 and 3, 1, are on opposite points on the sphere, which means that they equal mixtures of any of them mixed to the maximally mixed state in the center. Since these all mix to the same density operator, they must give operationally equivalent statistics. Our measurements, I'm plotting in the Bloch cone formalism. So again, I've left out the y dimension. And you can describe POVM elements with this equation. So the z-axis here is this E0 parameter. And on this plane in the center, this describes projective the projective measurements in our inequality are on this plane, or on this ring specifically. And what I've plotted is the POVM elements that are related to outcome 0 for measurement M1, M2, and M3. And we can see that if you measure, if you apply measurement 1 to either of the first preparations, then you get perfect predictability. Same with measurement 2 and measurement 3 and so on, so you get perfect predictability for everything. And the final thing is that these three POVM elements average to the identity over 2, which means that they are equivalent to a fair coin flip. So in quantum mechanics, ideally, these are the states that you could use to violate this inequality. Unfortunately, we don't live in an ideal world, and we do have this problem that it's very hard to create states to verify these operational equivalences. Directly measuring an exact equality is totally unrealistic in any experiment, but what we do is use a general procedure to kind of infer statistics based on the measurements and preparations that we've done in the lab. We can infer what the statistics would be of probabilistic mixtures of those measurements. So I'll just give an example, assuming quantum mechanics, of how we have done this. I'll relax the assumption of assuming quantum mechanics later, but for now, it's easiest to use these pictures that I just introduced. So here are the ideal preparations on the xz plane of the Bloch sphere. But when we go in the lab, we're going to measure something different. And here's an exaggeration of a pretty bad experiment. I'm going to leave the y dimension out of this for now, but our results extend to this third dimension as well. So these six squares are, well, OK, I should say that we try to create these measurements in the lab, so try to create these preparations in the lab, and then we do a tomographically complete set of measurements on each preparation. Based on those measurements, if we are assuming quantum mechanics, we can fit our raw data we can find the points on the Bloch sphere of best fit to our raw data. We're going to call these points of best fit the primary preparations, and they're denoted by these blue squares. You can see that the equal mixtures, the three equal mixtures of these preparations 1, 2, and 3, do not all line up at the same point in here, and therefore we don't have the necessary operational equivalence. But what we can do is consider these things called secondary preparations, which lie inside of this convex hull of the primary preparations, and we can find secondary preparations which are kind of close to the ideal in the primary preparations, but which also all mix to the same point. And this gives us the operational equivalence that we're looking for. We can do the same trick with measurements. So again, here are the ideal measurements that we've tried to create, leaving the y dimension out of it. When we go in the lab, we find our measurements of best fit to the quantum model, call these our primary measurements. And then now we have a slightly larger convex space of measurements because we include these perfectly predictable measurements, which correspond to measuring the observable, the identity, or 0. So this measurement will always return outcome 0. This measurement will always return outcome 1. And then from this convex space, the last thing is these three measurements don't average to the maximally, or to the identity over 2. So they are not equivalent to a fair coin flip. But we can find secondary measurements which lie inside of this convex space, which do satisfy that constraint. So the last few slides, I was assuming quantum mechanics, but we don't want to assume quantum mechanics. It doesn't make sense to experimentally test non-contextuality if you're already assuming quantum mechanics, because you can just sit down with a pen and paper and show that quantum mechanics has a contextual theory. So we want our analysis to not depend on any specific theory. So instead of fitting to the best quantum model, we fit our data to the best generalized probabilistic theory. Generalized probabilistic theory is an operational theory where states and measurements are represented by lists of probabilities. So for example, a state in a GPT would be a list of the probability of getting every possible measurement outcome on every possible measurement. I say every possible measurement, but there's a trick that you can use, is that if you know that you have a tomographically complete set of measurements, or a set of measurements that can fully describe all possible measurements in your model, then you don't need an infinitely long list of probabilities to represent your state. You have a finite number. So instead of assuming quantum theory, we reduce our assumptions to the number of tomographically complete measurements in our system. Everything I've been talking about so far is with qubits. We've applied this assumption to qubits. In the lab, we create single photons and encode them in polarization, and that's what we'll test them on. So we will assume that that two outcome measurements are tomographically complete for our system. And we fit to a GPT with that constraint. After finding the points of best fit to the GPT, we can carry out that gives us the primary procedures. Then we can carry out our analysis to find the secondary procedures. So now I'll talk about the experiment. So as I said, we started with a heralded single photon source, or we started with single photons. The way we create those is with a heralded single photon source. So what happens here is this laser travels counterclockwise through this interferometer and interacts with a nonlinear crystal, where with some probability, a pair of lower energy photons will be created. They're created at opposite polarizations. So when they come out of the interferometer, they travel different ways at this polarizing beam splitter. One will go to our herald detector. And if we get a detection at this herald, that means that with very high probability, we have a photon in this fiber. So I'll call these the signal single photons. It's kind of a confusing word. But so our signal photons are polarized, and we can set their initial polarization with two wave plates. We couple them into single mode fiber. And then we have a set of wave plates, so the single mode fiber will perform a random unitary on our photons. Well, a random but constant unitary, so the photons which travel through it. It depends on the angles and the number of turns and twists in the fiber. So we undo that unitary using these compensation wave plates. And then we can set a measurement basis. And then we perform measurements with the polarizing beam splitter and two detectors, one in each outcome. So we'll label one of a detection in one of these detectors with zero, and with the other with outcome one, conditioned on the fact that we've just had a click in the herald detector. So here's an initial slide of our results. And hopefully you can't see any difference between the heights of groups of bars. That means that the data was very close to perfect. So on this scale, we can't see anything, but I wanted to show this plot because it gives an idea of what the ideal data should look like. So what I've plotted is for each measurement, 1, 2, or 3, or 1, 2, 3, or 4, what's the probability of getting outcome 0, given that you're measuring state, or you're measuring one of these preparations. So you notice that I've added a fourth measurement and two additional preparations. The reason for this is we wanted to make sure, well, for measurements 1, 2, and 3 are all in the same plane of the Bloch sphere. Or if you're talking about polarization, the Poincaré sphere. This fourth measurement measures circular polarization, which is the additional degree of freedom that we expect our system to have. Again, these four measurements, or this measurement and two others, we expect to be tomographically complete for our system. And these preparations, P40 and P41, create the positive and negative, the left and right circular polarizations of our states. So these red bars represent the raw data. Blue are our primary, the outcome probabilities for our primary preparations of best fit. And then the green are the secondary preparations that we found. You can see there's not a big change between the primary and secondary. And we've only found secondary preparations inside of this gray background because these are the only states and measurements that we need secondary preparations for to test our inequality. So if you zoom in a little bit further, you can see that there actually is some discrepancy on these bars. So now I've plotted the probability of getting outcome 0 given you've performed measurement 1 through 4 on these three equal mixtures of P1, P2, and P3. Something I'd like to point out is the difference between the red and the blue bars. So if you look at, so the red bars, again, are the raw data, and the blue are our primary preparations. And you see that the blue bars are kind of within one error bar of the primary data is within one error bar of the raw data for all of our preparations, for all of the probabilities that we measure. And then that's a good indication that our model, or generalized probabilistic theory, or model of best fit, well fits our data. Our data could be well explained by this model. We have a numerical statistical test to quantify the goodness of this fit. It's a chi-squared test. All I want to say is that our data passed that test, but I think this is kind of a nice visual representation of that. If you remember that fiber before between the preparations and the measurement stage of the experiment, that was actually necessary to get data that was this good. What we found is kind of interesting is that as we spun our preparation wave plates, the angle of our beam would deflect a little bit, and that would affect the coupling efficiency into our measurement detectors. So as a result, there was some correlation between the preparation and the measurement that was performed on it. When we tried to fit our data to a model with only three two outcome measurements were tomographically complete, we found that we didn't get a good fit because there was an additional degree of freedom which was introduced by this deflection caused by our wave plates. So it was kind of a challenge to reduce the number of degrees of freedom that our experiment was sensitive to.
So
yes?
You also put some compensating optics in there. How would you choose your compensating optics? I don't understand what...
How did we choose those?
Yeah, I mean, it's... How do you know that you're compensating? What is it you're compensating for from the fiber?
Right. So based on our preparations and our measurements, we can calculate what we expect the measurement outcome probabilities to be. So we want high predictability when we prepare preparation 1-0 or 1-1 and measure in the perform measurement 1 on either of those measurements. Now, what this fiber does is it, depending on, it's kind of a topological effect inside of the fiber, different polarizations of light will be affected differently. And what that will do is change the state from this point. So the incoming state and the outcoming state here will be affected upon by a unitary. So the way that we align these compensation wave plates is we try to undo that unitary. And the way that you physically do that is you prepare preparation 1-0, and you perform a bunch of measurements on it. And you turn these wave plates by hand until you get the measurement probabilities that you expect. And then you check that works for other preparations. Yeah. But I should say that these wave plates are held constant throughout the experiment. So we align them first and then don't touch them. But the preparation and measurement wave plates are rotated throughout the experiment. So we got a good fit to our model, and this is good evidence that our data really only did have 3 degrees of freedom. Now, the final thing that I want to show on this slide is that the secondary preparations, after we find them, respond exactly the same for one measurement, respond exactly the same for each measurement. So measurement 1 can't distinguish between preparations 1, 2, and 3. Measurement 2 can't distinguish between preparations 1, 2, and 3, and so on. That's proof that our secondary preparations are operationally equivalent, because that goodness of fit kind of gives us some evidence that these four measurements form a tomographically complete set. It's hard to do every possible measurement in the lab. We've acquired a little bit of evidence based on that these measurements are tomographically complete, and also based on It's kind of our what we know about polarization and the way it behaves. This seems like a good assumption. The final part of this slide shows the measurement M star. So that's the equal mixture of M1, 2, and 3. How it's probability of outcomes for any input measurement. And then after finding the secondary preparations, the probability of getting outcome 0 is always 1/2, showing that it's equivalent to a fair coin flip. So we did violate the inequality. This slide shows the 6 terms from our definition of A. And you can see that they're all, and these are calculated by applying the secondary measurements to the secondary preparations. And you can see that these are all very high. So that they're all above 0.995. And on average, we find A is equal to something very close to 1. And it's very many standard deviations away from our non-contextual bound of 5/6. So in conclusion, I hope I've convinced you that an operational definition of non-contextuality is a good notion of classicality. It's something that leads to an inequality, which is defined operationally. And it's maybe more applicable than the assumption of local realism. We've solved this operational equivalence problem, but under the assumption that we're able to perform a tomographically complete set of measurements to fully characterize our preparations, and set of measurements to fully characterize our measurements, and then we've implemented a test of this assumption and violated it. So thanks again to my co-authors, and yeah. So any more questions?
For the secondary preparation of measurements, are these computed from the primary ones? And then if they are, how you decided on the particular mixtures that you were working with?
Yeah, so they are computed from the primaries. We ran an optimization procedure to ensure that our secondary preparations were as close as they could be to the primary ones, because we expect that to give us a large value for A, but under the constraints that all the operational equivalences were satisfied. And that can be written down as a linear program. It's not, if you wanted to do a perfect job of optimizing, finding secondary preparations, it's actually a quadratic program, a quadratic optimization problem, which is, in general, harder to solve. But the linear program gave us very good results, so we were happy with that.
You say that you reached one preparation, and it might not be the ideal preparation from quantum theory, and so you did a sort of compensation, in the sense that ideally you expect the preparation to respond, that there should be a measurement associated with it, which is essentially deterministic, right? But so you don't get there, but you have something. I guess the question that I'm asking is, how do you know that instead of just not achieving one preparation, but being shifted to some other preparation, which is the actual preparation that you got, that in fact your preparation isn't steady, but that your preparation is essentially a noisy preparation. And so instead of being a point in lambda, you have a distribution on lambda, which might be centered around something and have a tiny little tail, but in which case instead of drawing dots, you draw sort of circles. And then if you do that, then when you talk about the overlap between this noisy preparation, which could be somewhere in this region, and this noisy preparation, which could be somewhere in this region, and I'm assuming that this is statistically what you have, right? So why do I think it's this preparation? Because these are my measurement statistics. But with a finite number of measurements, I'm not absolutely certain this is actually my preparation, but it's got to be pretty darn close to this preparation because of all the measurements that I've taken, these are the preparations. So
yep.
Really, it's not a point, it's a distribution. Right?
Yes.
And then if I say now the mixture of these two distributions and the mixture of these distributions, I can't say with any mathematical certainty that this mixture and this mixture are the same lambda state, because it could be that the real lambda is not intersector.
Yeah, that's a very good point. I have an answer to your question. yes, so really these, I'll just go back to the picture for the preparations. So you're right. I've represented these primary preparations as points in, we'll just go back to quantum theory, if that's OK for a second. Represent them as points, but really they are somewhere inside of this. They're in some kind of confidence region around these points. The short answer to your question is the way that we got an error bar on our, or one way that you could get an error bar on A is to perfectly know the noise model of your state, or of your experiment, find all of these points, and then perform a Monte Carlo simulation and kind of sample points around here, sample points in the confidence region around each of your preparations and measurements, and then see how much your value for A changes, and then see how that affects the inequality. We kind of did that in the lab. Well, we did do that in the lab. We repeated the experiment 100 times. And each time we found a value for A which was very similar. As far as Monte Carlo standards go, 100 repetitions isn't a very high number, but that was the limit of what could be done overnight in a 12-hour time span. And that's how we got an error bar on A. So that's maybe an answer, that's the short answer to your question. Something that you could imagine doing is just repeating that process many, many more times to get a much better idea of kind of sampling all the possible lambda that your preparations could be in, and equivalently for your measurements. But I think that our analysis procedure is pretty robust to small changes in the preparations here. So if we change it by a little bit, say, let's pick this point, for example. If we move it in by a little bit, then this secondary preparation that we still found is still inside the inside this convex space. Maybe if we moved each of these points by a small amount and reran our optimization, we'd probably find secondary preparations, which are slightly different. But they're all going to lead to very similar values of A, while still giving us the operational equivalences that we need. And I think that that's kind of strong evidence that I think we've sampled the lambda space sufficiently to come to the same conclusion.
Here's my sort of confidence interval for all the six regions. Mm-hmm. And then this sort of intersection of the three of them also now becomes a region. And because it's this, we're looking at effectively secondary preparations, the point of the triple intersection, because you can say, I can take a lambda from this confidence region, a lambda from this confidence region, a lambda from this confidence region, a lambda. And for any six lambda which are in these six confidence regions, there is a preparation procedure which goes from primary to secondary, which gives an A.
Yeah.
Right? But that procedure is going to give me a different A for the different starting lambdas.
Yeah, exactly.
So I'm wondering if you could say, this is what the distribution on the mixture of all three is after doing this transformation on the confidence intervals.
So are you proposing, yes, what you just said. So I guess you are. You're proposing finding a distribution on the center point and showing, I think it would be nice to show that those distributions equivalent, or are you just curious as to what the
Yeah, I mean, I would find that to be a more convincing statistical analysis, which is to say that even if I think this is the preparation, but that's actually the preparation, it's not the point. The point is I can always do one of these secondary preparations for whatever is initially there and obtain a lambda, which will be an equal mixture according to the three secondary preparations. Mm-hmm. And then on that, this is the violation of the inequality. And then I think that this is my best guess for where my preparations are, which means this is my best guess for what is the equal mixture after doing the secondary. But you should be able to say something like, this is the distribution of my confidence in this particular lambda being the actual equal distribution.
Yeah, I think that would be a principled, nice way to do the analysis. It sounds very hard to do this fitting procedure and take errors on your raw data, turn it into errors in your model, and then turn that.
Well, the only reason I tend to push this is because if we consider like one standard deviation away, and we are adversely considering this, right, worst case, mm-hmm. Then even after you do your secondary procedure, you could end up being screwed, right? You could end up not getting the contextuality violation. Or can you say, no, even if I try to choose the worst possible lambda within my confidence region, such that I want to consider the lowest possible violation of the inequality that I could get, it's still a low cost.
Yeah, so we don't have numbers for that, for the reason that so that is something we consider doing, and it's a very difficult problem to solve. I think the fact that we've performed the experiment many times and find small variations in A, that gives us a sparse but still a sample of the distributions of lambda. And I think the fact that our value for A doesn't change by very much. It changes by a very small amount relative to its distance from the non-contextual bound. That is evidence that if you were to fully perform that procedure, then I think it would give you, it would still give you a violation. But
no more questions. Let's thank Mike again.